Last week on Truth and Justice, we heard from former FBI and Department of Defense interrogator Tim Clemente. Tim returned to the show to provide his analysis of Jesse Miss Kelly's interview where he confessed, as well as implicated Damian Echols and Jason Baldwin in the murders of Stevie Branch, Michael Moore, and Christopher Byers. As I mentioned on the Friday follow-up, my intention for today's episode was to move on to a new subject. But in the light of Tim Clemente's analysis, there is simply no way that we can just breeze past or move on from Miss Kelly's statements. At this point, we need to take a deeper dive and a closer look. Given the fact that Mike and I were in Nashville for CrimeCon over the weekend and into the early week, we decided that there was simply not enough time for us to research, write, record, and edit a different episode this week. Fortunately, while we were at CrimeCon, we recorded a live podcast that was originally intended to be used as our Friday follow-up. And since a lot of you had a lot of questions and comments about Tim's interview, we decided to move this Live at CrimeCon episode to this week's main episode. So what you're about to hear is a live session recorded at CrimeCon with right around 250 people in the audience who were asking questions about everything from our Season 1 case all the way up to our current case. We did have a little bit of trouble with the sound quality as the guy that was running the audio booth wasn't really keeping up on the sound levels very well, but I think that we got most of that corrected, and I hope that all of you will find this interesting. Next week, we will be diving back into Jesse Miss Kelly's interviews and confessions. But as for this week, after a short break, we'll be coming to you live from CrimeCon. Today's episode is sponsored in part by Uncharted. The Uncharted Supply Company has designed a survival system to help you act quickly and confidently when the unexpected happens. Did you know that 95% of all survival situations are actually resolved in 72 hours? What you do in those first 72 hours can mean the difference between life and death. Curated by survival experts, the 72 survival system contains quality tools and instructions you need to survive in a hurricane, earthquake, or any emergency situation. And all the tools are housed in a roll-top backpack that's so airtight, it can even be used as a flotation device. I received my 72 survival system a few weeks ago. For any of you that follow along on Snapchat or Instagram, you saw my unboxing of it. And I was amazed at the quality of the tools and the usefulness of everything packed into this small backpack. It's small enough that you can fit it in your trunk, put it in your basement. You can store this backpack anywhere where you may encounter a survival situation. The 72 has over 35 high-quality tools organized with simple instructions. Each piece in the kit has been vetted by experts including military, first responders, mountain guides, doctors, and more. And the insert not only organizes and color codes tools by use case, but also provides simple instructions, organized by need, food and water, shelter and warmth, or first aid. It's lightweight, it can fit easily under your desk, in a closet, or in the back of a car. When you're on foot, the hip and sternum straps hold the backpack close to your body, and the 72 only weighs 11.5 pounds. Times are changing, and the 72 is the product every home, office, and car in America should have. When an emergency arises, be a part of the solution, because the more prepared you are, the safer the world is. And right now, my listeners get $50 off at unchartedsupplyco.com when you use my code TRUTH at checkout. That's $50 off your survival system. All you got to do is use my code TRUTH at unchartedsupplyco.com for $50 off. How's everybody doing? So, our goal is to use this episode as next week's Friday follow-up because we're very, very lazy. And we want to stay an extra day in Nashville when this is over, and so we don't want to have to record a Friday follow-up next week. So do you guys think that you could participate with us and help make this our Friday follow-up? All right.
That'll do.
That'll do it, yeah. All right, so you guys are going to see how we record our Friday follow-up, sort of. Because what's going to happen is we're going to chit-chat a little bit. We'll introduce you and tell you what we're going to be doing. And then Mike, instead of reading your emails and your tweets and your Facebook messages, is going to wander around the room with the microphone and call on you guys and let you ask the questions directly to me. These are the ground rules. There are no ground rules. You can ask me whatever you want. It doesn't matter if you're talking about our current Season 5 case, the West Memphis 3 case, all the way back to Season 1, if you want to talk about how we do our jobs. Whatever you want, this is all about you guys. It's a Q&A between you and us directly. And Mike is terribly uncomfortable being on stage, so can I get...
Terrible stage fright. It's terrible.
So can we get one more round of applause for Mike?
Thanks, Bob.
So this is how we do it. When we're recording every episode, I leave little notes for Mike on the recording because Mike does all the editing and makes it sound good. So we'll do something like this. Mike, go ahead and leave all that in as an intro, and then we're going to drop in the music, okay?
You got it, man.
So right here, we're going to leave 47 seconds of silence.
Awesome.
Got it?
Yeah.
That's what happens when we record. But seriously, leave those 47 seconds of silence. Buddy, and welcome back to Truth and Justice. I'm your host, Bob Ruff, and this is my amazing co-host, Mr. Mike Bussing.
How's it going?
This is your Friday follow-up episode to no particular episode at all. We are coming to you live from CrimeCon, typically. So this is what's happening. We're recording this on Friday at CrimeCon. We have a much larger than is deserved studio audience here in front of us. We're all very uncomfortable. But the episode for this week hasn't dropped yet, the interview with Tim Clementi. So maybe you guys can make some predictions, whatever you want to do. So we are going to do this live recording. We're going to let Mike wander around and ask you guys, let you guys ask me directly the questions you want to ask. Just by a quick raise of hands so we know if this is going to work or not. Will you raise your hand if you think you got something you might want to ask us? Okay, we need more than three. More hands. Lie to me. Raise your hands. What if you want to just tell us how great Mike is? Raise your hand. Okay.
We need
this to go on for a good 40 minutes. Okay, you guys can handle that? All right. And as we say, let's go ahead and get started, Mike.
Let's do it, man.
The microphone. You got to get closer to the professional
use.
Podcaster.
Yeah, right. Do this for a living.
Right. All right, let's go ahead and get started. And you want to go ahead and get started with the questions. Start wandering around the room. So raise your hand if you have... Oh, we got a big hand over here, Mike.
All right, I think I see it. It's good to be on that stage. What's your name?
Caroline.
Happen to live in Nashville, so one of the crime contacts. Love you, think you're the most amazing investigator ever. May I deduce from your pause on the current season?
Hold on 1 second. Mike, can you get that? That mic's got to be a little closer to her face. You can even let her hold it. May you deduce. I'm ready.
May I deduce from your pause in the current season that you have hit on something that current investigators are already working on?
You may deduce anything you'd like to. that's a good question. And like I said, there's a potential for a pause. And this is so, I feel like it's so cloak and dagger and we're like building up this this big mystery. And I hate doing that, but I also have to try to keep you guys informed. So our intention with this case, the Forgotten Three, was to, like we do every case, cover it till it's done. Mike and I planned for a solid year. All I can really tell you, and I swear I would tell you more if I could, is that some things have happened. We've discovered some things. There have been developments that may cause us to have to pause the broadcast of the investigation. So we'll be continuing to do the work, but we won't be able to be talking about it on the podcast. And you can deduce whatever you want from that. There are... thanks, both of you, for clapping. There are a lot of different reasons it can cause that. As a good example, in Edward A's case and Jesse Eldridge's case, our season 2 and season 3, we reached a point where we were able to get prosecutors to reopen. We had attorneys involved, and they came to an agreement, said, okay, we're going to start working on this case to try to bring it to a conclusion, but we need you to stop talking about it right now. So in Ed's case, for sure, you know, we were able to kind of spring on you guys, hey, Ed's going home. Can we talk about that for a minute? And that is how you transition away from an uncomfortable question. Mike, you want to bring it to this young lady here in the front row? Good question. What'd you say your name was again?
Caroline
from Nashville. Love you too. It's my wife right there. Who are you?
Fast Fingers Jennifer.
This is Fast Finger, you guys remember from the Friday follow-ups? Very good question. So for those of you who aren't familiar, how many of you, by raise of show of hands, have listened to the season 2 case? Most of you, a good portion of you. Okay, so there's different levels of the DNA results coming back. So, you know, the first thing that they'll do is they'll do what's called quant testing to see if there is any DNA, viable DNA, in any of the evidence that we've sent out. Once that comes back, they can screen it and see is it male or female, and then they keep narrowing that pool down to when they get to the point where they have something where they're trying to get a full profile from. And the Ed's DNA, or the DNA in Ed's case, was sent out in several different phases for cost. Now, another thing that has been pretty amazing is that the Truth and Justice listeners paid for all that DNA testing, and that's why they're able to test everything. My understanding is that we should have a round of DNA testing back sometime this month or the end of next month. But again, this is one of those points where we were able to negotiate with David Dobbs and even with Matt Bingham, although he doesn't particularly care for me, to reopen the case and allow the DNA to be tested. Part of that was that Allison is not allowed to talk to Bob Ruff about it. So I don't know a lot of what's going on. I'm able to get little bits and pieces of it, but from what I've gathered from Allison, within the next month or so, I think we should have some results. Take your time, Mike. Notice Mike wearing his True Religion jeans. We don't go anywhere without our True Religion jeans. Use our promo code TRUTH. Yeah, they're going to give you some sort of a discount.
Hi.
What's your name?
Cynthia.
Hello, Mike.
Cynthia, where are you from?
I'm from Charlotte.
From Charlotte. Did you drive?
Yes.
Nice. That's not very far, is it?
Well, far enough.
Far enough.
So I have two questions. One is that from season 1, the Adnan Syed case I hear is being re-looked at. Is that true?
What do you mean by being re-looked at?
I heard that it was going to be appealed.
Yeah, well, so where we're at with Anand's case is he had a PCR hearing in February 2016. July of that year, the judge ordered the conviction to be vacated. The state then appealed that. That process took about 18 months. We just got the ruling from the higher court, from COSA, the Court of Special Appeals. They upheld the fact that his conviction is to remain vacated. So his conviction is still set aside. They kind of flip-flopped the reasons, but left it vacated. As of right now, the state, I believe, has 13 days left to decide if they're going to file an appeal to the next higher court in Maryland. They had two options where they could ask for it to be remanded back down to the lower court, or they could send it back up to the Maryland Court of Special Appeals. No, that's the one. A higher court, the Maryland Supreme Court, I think. So if they do that, then we could be in for another year or 2 years until we get another ruling on it. In the meantime, he could be eligible for bail. If
they choose not to appeal it even higher, then his conviction will officially be set aside, and then it's up to the state to decide if they want to take him back to trial again or to drop the charges and release him.
And then what are you looking at for season 4? You want to share?
For season 6?
I'm sorry.
You stopped listening after Jesse Eldredge. We don't actually know yet. So we get cases submitted to us all the time. You know, we kind of have the reputation for a lot of opposing viewpoints as we just think everybody's innocent, and that's not true, and Mike can attest to this. We are constantly looking at cases, digging into them, and determining, I'm not sure that this person is factually innocent, or I'm pretty sure they're not actually innocent. So it's a tough screening process because everybody's innocent, right? So they all tell us that they're innocent. So we haven't been actively looking for cases until all of a sudden, you know, we get this development. It's like, man, we could possibly have to pause our season 5 case here in just a month or two, so we need to find another case. So we're still looking for submissions. Right now we've got one that, to be honest with you, I'm hoping it works out. It is the defendant is a female. It's a triple homicide. But it's, I guess we can talk a little bit about the process for our selection. Number one, we won't take a case unless we believe that the person is likely actually innocent, that they were wrongfully convicted, because our major focus is on the victims. And so if, you know, we're not looking for technicalities to get somebody's conviction overturned, because that doesn't bring any justice for the victims. What we're looking for is they got the wrong person, and we need to find the right person so that they can pay for what they did. So there's a number of things we got to look at. Is the person actually innocent? Unfortunately, one thing that's I don't want to say that we need a defendant that is somewhat likable, but to an extent, you know, so we've had cases, I'll give you an example. We've had some cases submitted to us where the person was convicted of a murder and they didn't actually commit the murder. As we dig deeper, it was a drug deal gone bad murder, and this person was one of the drug dealers but wasn't the one that actually pulled the trigger, and the other person snitched on them. That, for us, it's tough, and it's just the reality of it. It doesn't make a good case for us, because it's going to be real hard for you guys, the audience, to really have a lot of sympathy for someone who was standing right there but maybe didn't pull the trigger. So, and the other thing is there enough evidence available for us to dig any deeper? In this one case that we're talking about, this female defendant with the triple homicide, it's a recent case. It was, I think, 2007, Mike, is that right? Yep, 2007. So there's a lot more. We have never done a case that's been that new. So there's a lot of evidence for us to be able to look at and go through. And also, she has family members that have reached out to us that already have trial transcripts and a lot of those things, because it's a huge expense. It's a lot of traveling, and it's a lot of time. You know, if we're lucky, we don't have to pay a dollar a page, because that's the typical rate when we go to a clerk's office to get copies of strands. So, for example, Edward Eight's case, there was 4,000 pages of transcript at a dollar a page. So if we're lucky, we can get them to let us take our little portable scanner in, which is this little box that's really slick, because it takes the scans and sends them to Dropbox for us. It scans 20 pages at a time. So there's been, in the Smith County, Texas clerk's office, Mike and I have spent 3 days straight in there unbinding each volume and then sending 20 pages through, and then keep another 20 to keep it going. And then one of them gets wrinkled up and you got to start the whole thing over. So that matters. So those are a lot of things that go into our screening process. If you happen to know about a case, we really want to, you know, season 5, the West Memphis 3 case, is super complex, super interesting case. It's really, to be honest with you, super difficult for us to do cases like that, because there's so many people that are ingrained in the innocent or guilty camp. And what it becomes is a lot of noise, a lot of fight. People get so emotionally, it's not just they're presenting fact and opposing viewpoint fact, but it's just a lot of negativity and nastiness. And what we're trying to do is to spread truth, spread justice, spread hope and love is what we're trying to do. And this case it's a struggle for us. So we want to kind of go back to our roots with this next case and pick somebody that none of you have ever heard of and introduce you to somebody new. Oh, I thought you were going to get the guy with the black cowboy hat, and then you got the guy with the red cowboy hat. There's only two cowboy hats in the room.
I'm Kata.
Kata?
Kata.
Kayla. Where are you from? Not America.
England.
England. Thank you for traveling all the way here. Thank you so much. I heard the first part. Do I have an opinion who committed the murders?
How's that opinion changed during the course of the podcast?
That's a really good question, and to be 100% honest with you, I don't have an opinion on who killed them. So I did. So let me put it that way. After, you know, when we first started looking at the case, this started with us studying this case, as we study many wrongful conviction cases, to learn lessons and look for patterns and figure out how these wrongful convictions happen. And so, of course, this one was great because there's all these documentaries and there's books and there's all this out there. And I did come out with the opinion that a lot of people came out with based on what was presented in the documentaries, that it was potentially one of the stepfathers. There was some evidence. As I've started to dig deeper, what I've found is that there's so many, you know, we're doing, how many of you are going to come to our presentation tomorrow morning on tearing down the misconceptions? Awesome. I won't be there alone at 8:45 in the morning. But you know, obviously you guys are listeners, but you'll see there's so much in this case that you think you know that you don't really know. So many things that were glossed over. The process of making a movie or a TV show, I don't know if you guys know this, but sometimes if you're on a TV show, they'll edit it so much that you can't tell anything that you said. But so I'm finding that a lot of things that I thought I knew, I don't really know. So I wouldn't even say that I have a prime suspect. I have what I believe is a good profile of who the unsub might be. But let's look, for example, what nobody's ever really looked into. When we traced the steps of the Forgotten Three, of Stevie, Michael, and Christopher, and really looked into all the door-to-door notes and really looked at where they were traveling and when, and found out that they actually weren't together for most of the afternoon. And we also find out that they came in contact with several people. You know, I've maintained that there's no possibility that someone was laying in wait in those woods for these boys, because no one could have known that they were ever going to go there. So I believe that whoever killed them followed them into the woods. Well, we have Michael Moore had an interaction with, I believe the door-to-door note read that he was seen calling two black guys' names in somebody's yard. There was also, don't forget about the egging of a house that happened right by the crime scene. So there's a lot of things there. There's the Jesse Miss Kelly had an interaction with a guy named Tracy Laxton, who was hiding in the woods asking little kids to come down and drink with him. So there's so many avenues that still need to be explored that I'm not prepared to even say that I have an opinion yet on who might have committed the murders. And with that being said, I want to point out that, as most of you probably know, tomorrow is the 25-year anniversary of the murders of Stevie, Michael, and Christopher. And guys like Terry Hobbs and John Mark Byers that have been kind of drug through the mud as suspects in this, you know, we're going to investigate everybody thoroughly, but let's remember tomorrow that, as of right now, these are innocent men and they lost a child.
Hi, my name's Julie. I'm from Gainesville, Florida.
Jolynn?
Julie.
Julie. Julie from Gainesville.
I have a comment and a question. The comment is, I loved your reaction on the phone when you heard the news about Ed Eights. That was great.
Me crying and mumbling, right? Thank you.
speaking of the Westminster 3 case, I was wondering if you realized what a hot mess you had stepped into when
I did. She's giving it back to me. I kind of knew what was coming. I tried to warn Mike and Shane, and I think you've been a little surprised. Can you want to turn that on? What has your reaction been to?
I mean, you gave us a fair warning, and I think with what we do, we've learned pretty quickly to push aside negativity and some of the bad stuff out there on social media, because I think at the end of the day, we're trying to do the right thing.
And Mike is much better at ignoring that shit than I am. I do pretty good. I do pretty good about just letting stuff go. But if anybody that follows me on, especially Twitter, I get nasty on Twitter sometimes. but I will occasionally engage. But it's hard, you know. So we knew. I warned them because we went through with an Ansayed's case. This one we knew was going to be worse because there's 25 years of innocent and guilty camps built. And it's not just innocent or guilty. It's guilty, innocent, and he did it, innocent, and he did it, innocent, and they did it. There's all these different camps. So it's a little worse than expected. But to be honest with you, I got to hand it. Mike really keeps me centered and reminds me sometimes to just ignore it and get back to work. He's actually the mature one. You'd be surprised.
Cleveland.
Hi, Becky from Cleveland.
I have two questions. First, I want to say congratulations on Ed.
Thank you. Congratulations, all of you, on Ed.
And another update on Jesse's case and how he's doing.
So Jesse's actually having a little bit of a hard time right now. He went through. I don't know all the details because I haven't been able to speak with Jesse. He had some conflict with his cellmate. And he ended up moving cells, but then right after that, the prison went on lockdown. So I'm in pretty constant communication with his wife Patricia, and she said he's struggling. He's because and this happens. It happened with Ed too. Once we move on the podcast to the next case, there's always that core of people that really get attached to. Each person, you know, as Jennifer mentioned, she's gotten really close with Ed. Kathy McElhaney right here is one of our listeners who has just been almost a weekly or daily pen pal with Jesse. And that means so much to them. And it's like all that kind of the hype dies down, and then it's the waiting game of waiting for DNA testing and stuff. So Jesse's doing okay. He's struggling a little bit. It would make his day if anybody wrote him a letter. I know that. As far as his case, he's kind of about the same boat as Ed. They both have DNA testing in progress, but it was sent. Both of their the evidence was sent to two different labs. So Jesse's was actually sent before Ed, but that lab had a longer wait, and then Ed's was sent after to a different lab. By midsummer, I hope that we have some conclusive answers. In Jesse's case, though, I'm very confident in this case because of the fact that we have the Conviction Integrity Unit working on his case. I know, as a matter of fact, that we have convinced them of Jesse's innocence. So they are now actively searching for anything to convict to vacate his conviction because they know that he's innocent.
The other question is on the West Memphis 3 case. So far, to this point, what surprised you the most?
Every day something's surprising me. But I'll go through a couple, because one of them that was the biggest surprise to me was after watching the documentaries and watching and reading The Devil's Knot and reading The Blood of Innocence and all the different media that's out there on the case, I was shocked when I started doing the study of victimology and found out that everything that I thought I knew about where the boys were at that afternoon and what they were doing was completely wrong. I mean, it just couldn't be more wrong. That was my first big surprise, was to find out that the three boys weren't just happily playing together all afternoon, that it was a very different circumstance. Damien's alibi was another one that surprised me, and that's still a controversial issue. I mean, I'm not here to say that we know 100% that he has an alibi, but that we know where he was at, but certainly it is stronger than a lot that I've seen. And I was shocked because I was always kind of told that he didn't really have an alibi, and they weren't wrong in saying that when Damien said, I don't really know where I was, or he said he was here, and then he changed it, well, maybe I was here, and then changed it to there, but as we always do, we're looking for the periphery, we're looking for, you know, because if anybody's going to lie, it's going to be the suspect. We're looking for on the periphery of people maybe not directly connected, and for things that we can corroborate, and as you heard, for those of you that heard it on the investigation on the podcast, he's got a lot stronger alibi than I thought, and that was pretty surprising to me.
Hi, I'm Suzanne. I'm from Bend, Oregon.
Hi, Suzanne.
Hi. So two questions. One, do you believe you know who killed Elmora Griffin and also killed Hay? And do you think Don and his mom are worried right now with everything going on?
Man, you made that question harder to answer with the last bit of that. I was so... I'll start with Elnora Griffin, season two. I believe that I know who killed her. I believe that it was more than one person involved. Without getting into it, and
male and female,
perhaps a male and female. To be honest, that is the case that I am so far the most proud of, not just for me, but for all of us working together. That is when we really dug into and all of us learned together how this crowdsourcing thing works and how we can all become cogs in the wheel of this machine that is seeking justice. And to take that investigation from nothing to where we have a clear picture of what the most likely outcome is. And I'm really hoping that we get some conclusive answers with the DNA testing. And also, I can report this because I harassed him. And you guys may be aware of this guy that I work with every once in a while. You guys ever heard of a guy named Jim Clementi? Jim, as you know, has been a huge asset to our work on the air, but what you guys may not realize is he's also been a huge asset off the air. You know, Jim is my mentor, I would say. I mean, he teaches me a lot. He also makes a lot of connections for us. And in this case, there were fingerprints. So for those of you that aren't particularly familiar with our season two case, there was during the commission of this murder, there was an old wall phone ripped off the wall, carried across the house and laid on the floor in the bedroom where the attack occurred. So, killer touched the phone, right? Obviously. There's a big fat-ass thumbprint right there on the side of the phone. And in 1993, there was no such thing as APHIS. So all they did was compared it against Ed Eights. They compared it against the victim. And they even compared it against her boyfriend, and it didn't match any of the three. You know who I think was the one who likely pulled that phone off the wall. And the fingerprints were lost. They, you know, Matt Bingham checked in it. They knew it. They went to the FBI lab. They were lost. So I called up my buddy Jim Clementi and said, hey, do you still know some people at the FBI? Jim made connection after connection after connection until I was able to get in touch with the person that physically went through boxes and boxes and boxes and found the fingerprint card. I don't know what's exactly being done with that at the moment because I'm not allowed to know, but I know that it is going to be run through APHIS. And I also know that the particular person who I think belongs to that fingerprint is not in APHIS, so it may require a little bit of detective work. So if that fingerprint gets run through APHIS and it comes back with zero, with nothing, then I think we have a very strong potential of solving the case with the thumbprint. What was the other one? Pardon me? I can't speak to how if anybody's worried or anything. I wouldn't have any way of knowing that. I think that I would say that there are particular people connected to some of our cases based on the work that we've been doing, all of us together, that ought to be pretty damn scared right now.
Hi, I'm Raven, and I'm also from Nashville, so I got lucky as well.
Awesome. Nice to meet you, Raven.
Nice to meet you. So my question is, I'm in the Facebook group, and there are some posters who, at first for a while, I just thought they were kind of like cantankerous and like to just start arguments, and it feels like they're talking in circles where no matter how much evidence or whatever I provide for a certain point, they have some technicality that it gets off and it drives me insane.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, do you think there are moles in the group who are related to the case who are in
charge? Oh, I'm sure, yeah.
And my other question was, do you think that Todd and Dana Moore are in the group under a secret name?
I don't know. To be honest with you, now, and I don't want to come across as though I'm saying anybody that has an opposing viewpoint or thinks the West Memphis Three are guilty or some kind of troll or have some kind of hidden agenda. There are people that have strong counterpoints in cases, but there are, I have a really hard time understanding the mentality of the amount of energy and effort people put into spreading hate about this case and just arguing. And so when I kind of try to like profile certain people, you know, when you look and you know when there's a fake profile, there's many of them on there and you wonder who they are and what their motivation is. But I think that there are several, I guess it would be a mole in the group. I think there are definitely people in the group that are connected to the case for sure. As far as Todd and Data Moore, I don't know because I don't think so, to be honest with you, because I know that they are active in other groups under their real names, and they haven't tried to hide their names or anything like that.
Hi there, my name is Stephanie. I'm from Springfield, Illinois.
Nice to meet you, Stephanie.
Me too. This is a surreal moment because I'm usually driving while I listen to you. I want to let you know I've been listening since Zero Dynasty, episode 1.
Well, thank you.
Hands, anyone else? Yeah, exactly. And so I guess I just want to know, you left your job as a fire chief, right?
Right.
And now you're a podcaster.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel or how do you think that the podcast, the True Crime Podcast, is changing our social justice, our criminal justice system, and what do you hope that it will do for the future?
It's a great question. For starters, I would love to have police academies and detective academies and even law school when people are training to be defense attorneys and prosecutors. I would love to hear them say, do your job like some podcaster is going to talk about it in front of millions of people. Because it's all about transparency, and that's what we're doing. And that's why there's, you guys have heard the evolution of Allison Clayton, right? And can we have a hand for Allison Clayton of the Innocence Project of Texas? When we, and Mike is witness, and when we first started working with her, Michael Ware assigned her to this case, and he's like, you're going to be working with a podcaster. And she was like, And then we started working together, and she was very much hesitant. Lawyers are trained not to speak to the media, and went from just being really irritated that she was saddled with a podcaster and all of his crazy listeners to having her and her boss begging us to take more of their cases. And it's not just us. Look at what Undisclosed is doing. Can we have a hand for Undisclosed? Rabia and Susan and Colin have innocence clinics from around the country asking them for help. So we're making a change where we're exposing the corruption that's out there. Now, unfortunately, a lot of our work is all about correcting things that happened in the past. But I hope that the overall effect is that it makes these people aware in the future. Hey, Mike, when you edit that, if you could bring when I stop talking and when they start clapping a little closer together. Nice to meet you, Sheila. Thanks for coming.
And Sunday, listening to that interview just made me want to hurt somebody. And so something since you're going to be talking to Tim Clementi, I want you to ask about, in the UK, they have made a nationwide effort to get away from leading questions called the PCK or something, to get away from the read technique. And I want to know if there's any effort in this country to work towards that.
Good question, and unfortunately, the way podcasts work is that interview on Sunday was recorded yesterday, so I won't be able to ask him that. But Tim's here, so for you guys, Tim Clementi is here, so you guys can talk. I actually was hoping to get him on stage with us right now, but he wasn't able to do it. He had other engagements. But yeah, the UK has made leaps and bounds in analyzing statements and doing statement evaluations in teaching a completely different way to interview. As I've said many before, we say read like it's a four-letter word. Wait for it. This is the best joke I had all day. It is, in fact, a four-letter word, but not that kind of four-letter word. Like it's a really bad thing. So here's the thing with read. The read technique becomes a very dangerous tool. And the reason is that it is very effective. And so what Tim was talking about was all read technique, and that is that's what I was taught, that's what he was taught. The problem, does anybody remember when I interviewed Jim Tranum a couple of years ago, who actually, using the read technique, accidentally got a false confession, which he's worked to try to correct after that? So it's effective at bringing people's guards down. It's effective to get them to open up and start talking. It's effective for getting in a confession. But what Jim Tranum said was, What they're not teaching are the side effects. He gave a great analogy. It's like giving a doctor a prescription pad without teaching him any of the side effects of the drugs that they have. For that reason, I would love to see it done away with and new interrogation techniques being taught. And I think that we should have an evaluation system like as they do in the UK. For those of you who aren't aware of it, it's actually like a checklist. If you go in and interview someone and they confess, there's a next step where they have to evaluate the interview, see where the information comes from. Did they implant the information? Did they make suggestions to the person that they were interviewing where that information came from? And if it doesn't meet the standard, it's thrown out. It doesn't count. In our system, the prosecutor is the gatekeeper, which, in my opinion, is it's... I don't want to... I'm going to say this as a little sidebar. It's nothing to do with your question. You're welcome. I sat on a jury Tuesday, which I don't know if any of you that heard the Friday follow-up today know that. And that was a good prosecutor, but it's still a messed up system. So the prosecutor asked me about my work on wrongful convictions, and I assumed he was going to boot me off. That's what usually happens. And he allowed me to stay on that jury. And so what I'm saying is there are good prosecutors out there, but When it came time for the trial, we still have an adversarial system where it's all about winning and losing. And he went up there and ended up securing a conviction against what I believe was an innocent woman. So having that guy that's in that adversarial situation in the courtroom being the gatekeeper for what evidence comes in, I think is a bad system. I wish that we would go to what the UK has.
Hello, I'm Alyssa from Texas.
Hi, Alyssa from Texas. Thanks for traveling.
What is the latest on George Powell in this case?
We're still waiting a ruling for that one. So George Powell was our mini season four. They went through the evidence, in my opinion, is overwhelming that he is clearly, factually, and actually innocent. So we're just waiting on a ruling for that. I know I've spoken with Michael Ware about it since the hearings, and he's very confident. But as he said, it's... in the American criminal justice system, who knows? But we should know about that very soon. I mean, we have a lot going on. We could, by the end of this year, we could see a whole bunch of people walk out of prison because of the work that you all are doing.
Can I just stand girl for a second?
Please do. Yeah, that's fine. Just let.
My name is Shelly. I'm from Moose Lake, Minnesota.
Hi, Shelly.
Hi. You obviously and the Truth and Justice Army have changed the world. But because you left a career and never imagined yourself sitting in front of a bunch of people like this, what is like your best moment and your, oh, I want a mulligan moment?
Well, the best moment's easy. Because, I mean, getting that call, as you guys all know, of all the cases, Ed and I got very, very, very close, and we continue to be. So this began, and I think you heard as season two progressed, me sounding super pissed. That was legitimate, because, you know, this became less about this case, and it became about what did you do to my friend. And so it'll tear me up now if I don't be careful. Getting the call that he was going home, hands down, the best moment since we've been doing this. The mulligans, I like a mulligan at least once a week. So, as some of you might know, on our Patreon subscribers get a video of the uncut recording of the Friday follow-up, and they see what an idiot I really am. And it also shows how much work Mike does, because I mess up a lot. But in the season three case, in Jesse Eldridge's case, in the murder of Kiao Gove, we had some leads that led us down to all the way down to a certain person that myself and several people that were working with me, we were pretty convinced that this person was either involved in the murder or knew who it was. Now, I was careful never to put this person's name out there because I wanted to make sure that we, as always, corroborate anything and find some substantial evidence before we start doing that. But if I had anything to do over again, I would have been even more careful because it was easy enough from what I said for people to track him down on Facebook. It worked out in the end. I was able to finally make contact with him and we did a long interview with him. Turned out to be, not only was he not involved, but turned out to be a wonderful asset and a great guy that helped us make a lot of connections. But that was one of those moments where I thought, it's like, man, you pulled the trigger too fast on that. You should have waited before you did that, because that luckily that worked out, but that had the potential to cause some damage.
I want to thank you for everything you do.
Wait, who are you?
Oh, I'm Emily.
Emily?
My beautiful sister, Stephanie.
Hi, Stephanie and Emily. California. Wow, thanks for coming.
I'm trying to do the accent while I'm here.
Awesome. See my wife. She does a great Tennessee accent. Becky does when she's here. Tonight at 8 o'clock at the Fuse Bar, by the way, there's going to be a whole bunch of us, True Crime Garage guys, myself, Generation Y, all of us are going to be down there. And Becky will have two drinks and start talking with a Southern accent, I promise.
All right, y'all. So, I want to thank you for everything you do. I really enjoy the podcast, and I'm like blown away with the work and the passion that you put into it. It moves me. There's been times that I cry while listening to the podcast.
Me too. Ed's case. 100%. I mean, I lose sleep over Ed's case now still.
Yeah.
You know, something will come in, I'll get some information. I hate that I have to be kind of in the dark with a lot of things that's happening. I still go through his case file often, you know, even when we're 4 seasons past that. Not only because of my connection with Ed, but the case, it's just, to me, it is so obvious who the prime suspect should be. And it's so frustrating that it was missed and how it was missed, that what happens to me is I'll lay down in bed at night and have, you know, well, what if we could do this? What if I could talk to this person? How can I get in touch with this person and try to interview them? I'll start going through an interview and interrogation process in my brain until 3 o'clock in the morning because I can't shut it off. So definitely Ed's case sticks with me all the time.
Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Hi, Jelaine from Vero Beach, Florida.
Hi, Jelaine. Nice to meet you.
Don't throw daggers, guys. I've never listened to the podcast. And I'm happy to be in here and love what all of you guys take from this podcast. So knowing what I know now, ideally starting at season one is where I should begin to listen to. Which season or episode do you want me to think about? Which one do you want me to listen to make me think?
Good. That's a good question. It's a hard question. As we've gone from season one to where we're at now in season five, a lot of things have happened. So each season obviously is a completely different case. I believe they're all extremely interesting, and I believe that they will draw passion out of anyone that listens to them. There's also the production difference, you know, where season one is literally me on a $20 microphone in my basement just like talking, right? As to where we're at now, where we have Mike doing the editing, and I wish Shane's actually from Nashville, and I'm hoping at some point he's going to be here. But can we get a hand for Shane Yoder from PutThemInASong.com? So we now have this. Not only Mike as the producer, we have Shane that writes, composes, scores music, does our sound design, and I think these guys make it sound pretty kick ass. So it's a big difference there. But it's. Man, I don't know if I could pick one. Again, I would point towards Ed's, but they're all so important. I think that season one case, if you've never... Have you listened to Serial?
Yeah.
The Serial, okay. Have you listened to Undisclosed or any of the follow-up podcasts about that?
No.
Okay, if you don't mind shitty production, listen to season one because that'll blow your mind.
I think you handle yourself very well. I see a lot of people kind of trying to poke at you.
Mm-hmm.
And you're very respectful. And
sometimes, every once in a while.
But overall, yeah. I think you do a very good job, and especially with the Western Memphis story stuff. It's
mm-hmm.
difficult to keep your cool with that sometimes.
It is.
My question is, have you ever considered looking into a case where someone is accused of something, not yet, weren't wrongfully convicted, but on their way there?
Yeah. Not necessarily for the podcast, because in an open case, like, there's a lot of things that can't be shared. But I actually have had, a couple of years ago, somebody that reached out to me that was in that situation. They presented, you know, they were awaiting a trial, and they're like, these people are railroading me. And without doing anything on the podcast, I was... So all of you make us matter, okay? And what I mean by that is I was able to actually reach out. I had to be in a firefighter, and it was a Michigan case for so many years in Michigan. I was a state instructor. I have a lot of connections with police and with law enforcement and in the fire department. I was able to reach all the way out and actually speak with the chief in that case and talk to them about, look, we're thinking about taking this case. This is what he's presented to me. And we had a few back and forth. Didn't really, you know, and we kind of told him that, just know that we're watching, and if this goes the way it looks like it's going, then we're probably going to end up talking about it on the podcast in a non-threatening, just very, very friendly way. And then next thing we know, the guy reached out and said they dropped the charges. So, and I can't say that that's necessarily 100% because of our conversations and the files that we shared back and forth, but I believe that it makes a difference. But again, we couldn't really do it on the podcast, but we do get that every once in a while. Somebody will reach out and say, hey, can you help me? I've got this going on. There was only the one instant we were ever able to actually intervene, and maybe, well, there was Abby, if you guys remember Abby, that was the case. That was pre-trial, we were able to intervene there. Speaking of which, do you guys remember that we put together a GoFundMe? This just happened, and it's nothing to do with your question. but in Abby's case, we put together a GoFundMe to help the state police train in a de-escalation class. And it was going to cost like $9,000. We put it up. We raised about $2,000. We had just raised $5,000 for Abby to pay for his attorney. And it kind of stalled out, and we haven't really known what to do with it. I've been in contact with the lieutenant at the state police post quite a bit. Her name's Mindy Logan. She reached out to me a couple of months ago and said, hey, I've got a great idea. They're actually teaching a train the trainer for that class. And it's $1,000 a person. I want to send two of our officers to the train the trainer so then they can come back for free and teach these de-escalation techniques to our entire department. And so we just wrote the check on Tuesday this week. So those donations did finally make an impact. And instead of just training, you know, 15 people, we now have officers in the state police of Michigan for the first time that are educated and able to train all of the Michigan state police officers in the de-escalation. We got time for maybe two more, depending on how long-winded I am.
I just want to hold the mic, not this mic, that mic. I know at the beginning of West Memphis, you kind of had your disclaimer about how this might not be a popular season. Was there ever a season you started that you thought you might lose all your listeners?
This one, yeah. Well, starting season two, I did. Because so, you know, this all, again, started as a hobby. And we're covering the Serial case, right? And so, you know, all of you that listen to Serial just are looking for more, 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 more. So my audience began building just for people that were looking for anything to do with Serial. And because people were so emotionally attached to Adnan and the story. And we built up this kind of relationship and this movement with, then Serial Dynasty becoming Truth and Justice. But I was terrified to go into start season two and start a brand new case that no one's ever heard of. And I definitely had a lot of, why the hell would people keep listening to me? Who am I? I'm starting this new case. And I was stunned that our audience not only stayed, but grew as we moved on to other cases.
Thank you.
Thank you. One more.
I'm Victoria from England, too.
Victoria?
Yeah.
Nice to meet you, Victoria. Thanks for traveling all the way across the pond. So, in the West Memphis 3, obviously they've already been, like you said, they've been released. They really can't go back to prison because they can't, for double jeopardy. That's why this really isn't about them. the effect it would have is I think I understood you right. You're asking, is there someone else that if it, I'll say this, as I've said, I don't know who the suspect might be. If there are any suspects, we're still getting there. If we were able to build a case to be able to prove who actually murdered Stevie, Michael, and Christopher, and we could present that case to the prosecutors and they reopen, then they could file charges against whoever is identified, and then the prosecutor could drop the charges against the three who were convicted that would give them a full exoneration and give them their life back. And I think on that, I know you guys, what time is it, Jennifer?
1:53.
Okay, we got one more. We'll do one more. Thank you for this good question.
Hi, I'm Shane from Chicago. My question is, have you seen Nancy as your peer? Can you please jump on out?
I have not. I haven't seen Nancy. That may be an odd. So here's the thing. That Nancy and I got along just fine. Like, during the tape, and that's what really irritated me about it, was during the taping, we were at each other, and they cut it all out, of course, every single point, the counterpoint that they had, but you know, we were at each other's throats during the taping. We go to commercial break, and she's like, oh, Bob, that was great, all right, let's keep that up in the next. So I don't know how much of that had to do with her or her producers, but after the email that I sent the producers, it'll be awkward. And on that note, thank you all for coming. All right, I hope all of you enjoyed that Q&A session from CrimeCon 2018. I know that Mike and I had a lot of fun, and hopefully this was a nice little break from the West Memphis 3 case for a week. Let us all cleanse our palates before we dig right back into Jesse Miss Kelly's confessions next week on Truth and Justice. Truth and Justice is a production of NBI Studios. Michael Bussing is your executive producer, and all music for the show was created and composed by PutThemInASong.com. I want to thank Amanda Meyer of Willow Photo and Designs for designing and creating our Friday follow-up logo. And a special thanks to Katie Ross of CreatedInTandem.com for designing, creating, managing, and maintaining our website. And also a big thank you to our transcription team, Sarah Mueller, Anna Dindorf, Britta Bliss, and Stephanie McConnell. And as always, thank you to all of you for all of your engagement and support. If you like the show and you'd like to support us, you can do so in a number of ways. To financially support the show, you can go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. On the Patreon page, you can pledge as little as $1 a month, and we also have reward levels on the Patreon page that include access to the behind-the-scenes videos of the taping of our Friday follow-up episodes, Truth and Justice Army t-shirts, Truth and Justice hats, and even the opportunity to co-host one of our Friday follow-up episodes. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. And lastly, you can always support us by supporting the companies that sponsor this program. But the most important thing that you can do is engage in the investigations. You can keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation in the Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. And for all of you tweeters, you can follow along on Twitter @TruthJusticePod. And don't forget that we always have our 24/7 voicemail line open for questions, comments, or tips on the case. That phone number is 269-224-2833. However you do it, stay engaged, stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
And I'm Mike Bussing.
And this has been Truth and Justice.